Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Obama is calling it an important precedent for Afghanistan democracy. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has agreed to a runoff election scheduled for November 7th, less than 3 weeks from today. Yesterday, a UN-backed panel threw out a third of Karzai's votes in the August 20th election. Today, the Afghan Independent Election Commission agreed there should be a runoff with former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah. Peter Galbraith is the former ambassador to Croatia and was deputy head of the UN mission in Afghanistan until he was forced out for voicing his concerns about election fraud. Ambassador Galbraith, you're not one to gloat, but are you feeling vindicated today?
Well, it's certainly true that what I was saying from before the elections, at the time of the elections and afterwards, has turned out to be exactly right. That said, this was an unnecessary crisis. If the UN had taken action before the elections, as I was trying to do, or had reacted to the fraud earlier, we would not have had this prolonged crisis that has so paralyzed Afghanistan and so seriously undermined international support for a very important mission in Afghanistan.
Well, given those concerns you expressed during the election, what's your sense of an election going forward?
Well, first, I think having a runoff election is by far the best outcome at this point in time. There was no good outcome, but simply to have a deal between Karzai and Dr. Abdullah, his main challenger, would not have been a good outcome. But now, the most important thing is to make sure that the second round is not a repeat of the first round. And there are three things that need to be done. First, the UN needs to stop pretending that the Independent Election Commission, this is the Afghan body that is actually responsible for running the elections, the UN needs to stop pretending that it is independent in anything other than the title. Its members were appointed by Karzai, and it behaved in an entirely partisan way. It needs to be closely supervised. Second, the fraud primarily took place in what I called ghost polling stations. These were ones that were located on a map in places either controlled by the Taliban or so insecure that no observer could go, no candidate agent could go, and no voter could go. I had been trying to get them shut down in July, but I was overruled. Well, now they need to be removed from the rolls. This is where the fraud took place, in places where there were no voters but many votes. And third, the staff of the so-called Independent Election Commission who participated in the fraud need to be removed. And it's very simple to identify who these people are. In every instance where there was fraud, Election Commission staff either committed the fraud, collaborated with those who committed the fraud, or knew about it and failed to report it. And so those people need to be replaced. That's going to be difficult in the 2 weeks between now and the holding of elections, but it's essential if anybody's going to have confidence in the second round.
Well, we haven't even mentioned that, as we said yesterday on the program, the snows in the mountain make it virtually impossible to get to some of the areas that would need to vote. Given all of that, do you think that this vote is going to take place on November 7th?
I think it should take place on November 7th. It's a tricky time of year, but not an impossible time of year. Most of the country is not covered by snow. It seems to me it's better to have an election than to have this crisis continue. If you didn't have the election, either you get some kind of deal, which I think many Afghans would view cynically, or simply the crisis continues and the question is, who's the president?
Well, and one of the deals mentioned is a power-sharing government with Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah, or a loya jirga, a traditional Afghan meeting to try to resolve the situation. But you say that those would be greeted with cynicism?
I think a deal that simply divided up jobs would be greeted with cynicism. A loya jirga that addressed some of the flaws in the Afghanistan constitution, I think, would be a very welcome development. The problem in Afghanistan is that you have a constitution setting up a very centralized system with just one really important job, the president. So it's a winner-take-all for one ethnic group. The president almost invariably is a Pashtun from the largest group. And so there's no real system of power sharing. What Dr. Abdullah has proposed, and I must say I think this makes sense, is that you have a system in which there's an elected prime minister and cabinet chosen by the parliament. The other part of this, I think, that needs to be considered is, instead of a very centralized system, having some devolution of power to local, elected local government.
But right now, as you said, it's winner take all, and most analysts, as you say, believe Karzai will be that winner because he is a Pashtun, one of the largest ethnic groups. So in the end, might there be an election on the 7th with the same exact outcome as the one in August? Karzai is the president in a very centralized government.
That could be the case. If it's an honest election, it's a much better result than what took place in August. But I think it's also, we shouldn't kid ourselves, it's also important to bear in mind that even if there's an honest vote in on November 7th, Karzai is not going to escape the taint of the fraud that took place in the first round. It comes on top of his running an ineffective administration, a corrupt administration, and now he has the taint of fraud. But it would be a much better outcome if he becomes president for another term as a result of an honest election.
I'm going to have to leave it on that somber note. Peter Galbraith, former deputy head of the UN mission in Afghanistan until he was forced out because of his complaints about fraud in the August election. Ambassador Galbraith, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, very good speaking with you.
More than 5 million Americans, roughly 10% of the industrial workforce, are employed by foreign companies in the U.S. They range from well-known Toyota to hardly known Indian and Chinese companies, Tata and Haier. They are in every state, and to lure them, local governments routinely dangle huge incentives worth tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. Is it worth the expense? Micheline Maynard says yes. In fact, she says not only do these foreign investments create thousands of American jobs, they pump billions into economies, strengthen communities, and teach Americans new and often better ways to work. Wait a minute. What happened to Buy American? Mickey's new book is The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. She's also senior business correspondent for The New York Times. We've spoken many times with her after her coverage of the car industry. And she joins us live from Detroit. Mickey, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And as you know, these are fighting words in some quarters. You know, the thinking, what can anyone else teach us about working? We're Americans.
Well, I don't know if you remember the movie Gung Ho, which came out a few years ago starring Michael Keaton, but it gave the picture of foreigners coming over here to teach us how to do our business. And I think in that movie, the Americans outsmarted their new owners. But in the case of the foreign companies that have invested in the United States, they're bringing ideas that Americans have actually gone to other countries to study.
Right.
But now, instead of having to get on a plane and go to Tokyo or Yokohama or wherever, the factories have been built here, and Americans are being hired to do those jobs.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that part, the part about changing the way we work. Let's start with the story of one worker, Norm Bafuno, who worked at GM for 14 years, at Toyota for 10 when you met him, Toyota in the U.S. Tell us a little bit about his experience. First of all, Toyota didn't care about his resume. They were looking for something different in their hiring. Explain that.
I actually met him when he was still at General Motors, and he was considered to be a young rising star at GM. And it was the kind of person that they would make available to reporters for interviews, and he was very popular with the people that he worked with. He came over to Toyota and essentially had to start over. None of that really mattered, although they would not have hired him if he didn't have promise. They were not hiring him to come in and teach General Motors methods to Toyota. On the contrary, he was there to learn about Toyota. And he went through quite a long apprenticeship, which is very, very unusual for an American manager at that point in his career.
In fact, they put managers in situations explicitly where they don't have skills, and they don't congratulate people for what's right, but rather looking for wrong. There's Japanese words that are used like kaizen, and have I got this right, genchi genbutsu?
Yes, kaizen means continuous improvement, and genchi genbutsu means go to the spot. In other words, don't wait for someone to come in and say, you know, this machine broke on the assembly line. You go to the spot. You go look at the machinery. You go talk to the workers and say, tell me what went wrong and tell us how you think we should fix this. It's definitely different from the American way of management.
Well, to the extent that there are no executive parking spots, no executive dining rooms, and the idea, I mean, it really is unbelievable that you put a manager where they aren't comfortable so that they have to learn along with everybody else. But what are you saying? This is Toyota, which, of course, has been much written about. You talk about other companies, Tata, Haier. What are you saying in general, that American corporations have it all wrong?
I'm not saying American corporations have it all wrong, but I'm saying that they're not the only answer, and they're not the only answer within the United States. One of the things that greatly surprised me was that foreign companies are in every state, and foreign companies are playing a significant role in manufacturing in very, very varied parts of the American economy. Certainly, we've heard the most about the automobile industry, but they're starting to come in aviation. I visited a helicopter plant in Mississippi that's owned by EADS, the big French-German consortium that you would probably know for owning Airbus. And what I found was that instead of just a few factories here or there, it's become a part of the American economy.
And why do companies want to invest here? We don't have cheap labor, so why are they coming here?
Well, first of all, we're still the most attractive consumer market anywhere. Until China becomes as affluent as we are, people want to be in the United States. The ability to enter the American market is fairly easy. We don't, although we have a history of protectionist rhetoric, we don't have a history of protectionism except in a few industries. And so it's pretty easy to come over here. And a very important factor is that mayors, governors, senators are falling over themselves to attract these companies.
Well, let's ask you about that, because many have questioned that aspect of this. You give the example of Haley Barbour, then governor of Mississippi, who put together a package worth $294 million in incentives to a company. That amounted to the state paying $147,000 for each of 2,000 jobs created. We spoke with Michael Schumann. He's a small business guy, author of The Small Mart Revolution. He says there's no evidence that money is a major factor in these decisions to bring in big companies, whether foreign or domestic. And you even write that more important to these foreign companies is the presence of a college in the area so that they can get, highly educated workers. So are states making a mistake in dishing out so much money to these foreign companies?
I remember when Alabama was going after its very first car plant and it offered a huge package to Mercedes-Benz. And it was a very expensive package. In fact, at one point, the state wasn't going to be able to pay it, and the retirement systems had to have to step in with a short-term loan to the state. But after Mercedes-Benz came the Honda plant, the Toyota engine plant, the Hyundai plant, many, many parts makers. And so I'm sure the state of Alabama would say that that original money that they spent for that factory is worth it. All these southern states, many of the southern states have looked at this and seen the jobs that come in, seen the new subdivisions that are built, the new businesses that come in, the new road systems that are built, and they all want a piece of this pie.
Well, that's Micheline Maynard. Her new book is The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. It's quite a provocative read. Mika, we have a lot of questions. What about unions? Here's one quickly before the break. How much of the money that these companies make and generate actually stays in the country? Isn't that a question? If they're foreign companies, yeah, they may be hiring American workers, but the money they're generating, doesn't that go back home?
Actually, about 49% of it is reinvested in the United States.
Okay, well, there's the short answer to that question, but we have many more. We'll be back with Mickey Maynard to ask them and ask about how people in small towns are feeling about foreign companies that they might have had, jingoistic feelings about coming to their town. After a minute break. Also later today, that other presidential stalemate, the one in Honduras that we don't hear that much about, that's later. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about foreign firms doing brisk business in the U.S. with Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times, also author of the new book, The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream. And her conclusion is that it's in an overwhelmingly positive way. And Mickey, we've been talking primarily about Toyota and the car industry, but you see this in a wide range of industries, hotels, tea, refrigerators, finance. Could you just go through a couple of the other successful examples?
Well, absolutely. I don't know who drank 8 o'clock coffee this morning, but 8 o'clock coffee is owned by Tata, which is a very large Indian company that might be best known to listeners as the maker of the Nano, the $2,500 car. They also manage the Pierre Hotel in New York City, which just got a big renovation. They own what's called the Taj Hotel in Boston that used to be the Ritz-Carlton, where I went to lunch as a young girl with my mother and enjoyed very much. And, you know, there are a couple of other industries, too. Airbus, which is the aviation wing of EADS, would like to come into the United States. They want the Pentagon tanker contract. It's a $35 billion deal.
Well, let me jump in there with a question, because we have so many, and one of them is about security. A lot of people worry that foreign investment, especially when it gets into things like military contracts, is dangerous for the country.
That is a concern, and there has been some concern in some of the IT deals that have gone through, and especially this tanker contract, which EADS actually won at the beginning and had it overturned by a GAO, General Accounting Office report that found flaws in the bidding process. Boeing, based in Seattle, does not want them to have that contract, and they're going to fight very vigorously in the second round of bidding to make sure that a French-German company doesn't get it. But if they do get it, they want to build a plant in Mobile, Alabama to produce those aircraft.
Well, that's one of the questions. And another is how small towns feel about embracing, let's put the name on it, foreigners, because there's the feeling that, you know, buy American, globalization is bad, and here comes some foreign company. In fact, you tell a story of a man standing up at a Rotary Club and saying, I don't want those Japanese here, I believe it was.
Yes, yeah. That happened in Georgetown, Kentucky, which is really kind of the poster child for every community in the country that wants a foreign investment. Georgetown, Kentucky, before Toyota came, had a little downtown and one McDonald's. If you visit Georgetown now, it looks like that scene in It's a Wonderful Life at Christmas, where the whole town is lit up and there are new restaurants and shopping malls and Walmarts and three McDonald's. And essentially, when Toyota came in there with Japanese executives, they made an effort to go to the Rotary Club and go to Kroger's and be out in the community so people wouldn't see them as some kind of a hidden enemy. And it has been an adjustment for some people working for a foreign company. In fact, I worked for one. I worked for the Reuters News Service, and I remember thinking, what will London want? And it turned out that it didn't really matter what London wanted. It was what my managers in New York wanted, and they were by and large Americans.
Well, and you've discovered that one of the reasons that these foreign companies so far have been so embraced is that they anticipated sort of an American pride and an American xenophobia, and they bend over backwards to avoid that, which is one of the reasons they've been so successful. You mentioned Tata buying the Ritz-Carlton here in Boston, making sure to keep the key staffers in place so that the same person's opening the door for you or other women from the Back Bay who are going there for lunch. They seem to be hyper aware of the needs of the communities they go to.
And I think it's an awareness that American companies have not always shown when they've built facilities overseas. And I've covered the auto industry for many, many years, and everyone sort of rotates through over there, wherever there is, and then comes back. And you don't have the stability that you might have if managers are hired locally. I think these companies have a ways to go because the leaders at the very top, the CEOs and the general managers at some of these factories still tend to be from the home office. But that's definitely changing. Norm Bufuno, who we talked about earlier at the Princeton, Indiana Toyota plant, he's now a vice president of advanced engineering at Toyota for North America. So people are being hired, trained, and promoted.
Well, but here's an issue, especially with the car industry. You write these plants, Toyota plants, for instance, one in Williamstown, Kentucky, really appealing, 80,000 people applying for 2,000 jobs. But these are not union jobs. And you're saying that the culture that's being created is sort of not leading to an embrace of unions because the workers are so happy. They're treated, I mean, this is your take on it, their opinion is respected and they haven't seen the need for unionization. But aren't they paid less? Let's be clear about what's the pay difference between some of these foreign companies and American corporations, because it was somewhat muddied during the collapse of the car industry months ago.
That's right. If you look just at the Toyota plant in Georgetown, Kentucky, the workers there make about $3 an hour less in pay, just pay, than workers in Detroit made before they made big concessions as part of the bailouts. They were making an average, and this is all in, including the value of benefits and the future value of pensions, of about $73 an hour. And it was less for workers at Toyota. It was more in the range of the high 40s. Well, now, people say this is an unfair comparison because right. the union contracts included these legacy costs like pensions and health care that were to be paid after retirement. Such costs are not paid by the other car companies. They offer 401k plans. Some do offer some pensions, but it isn't anything like what workers got in Detroit. But the thing is, there are a lot fewer workers at Detroit car plants than there once were. And these foreign car plants, by and large, are still hiring.
Well, and they're pledging in many cases not to let go of full-time workers. Mickey, we only have a minute left here. Some would say, though, but they may need unions down the road. They may say, you, Mickey Maynard, are drinking the Kool-Aid and embracing so much. You know, you say this, they are overwhelmingly positive for the U.S. What would you say to people still a little fearful of so much foreign investment in the U.S.?
You know, I would say what Governor Granholm in Michigan, who's a Democrat, would say, what Governor Barber in Mississippi, who's a Republican, would say, and that is jobs are jobs. And down the road, when the American economy recovers, we can talk a lot about a lot of these other issues. But if companies are willing to come in, build factories, and invest here, I think we should take the jobs and then maybe teach them how to do some things.
Well, and as you point out, younger generations, many of them don't even know Toyota is not an American-born company. That's Mickey Maynard. The Selling of the American Economy, How Foreign Companies Are Remaking the American Dream is her latest book. Mickey, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin. A pleasure.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
You may have heard about those climate change activists who claim to be members of the business-friendly U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They sent out press releases that actually got reported and held a fake news conference yesterday at the National Press Club, claiming the chamber was reversing its position and would now back legislation on climate change. Suddenly, a real Chamber of Commerce official burst in on them.
Okay, this is I'm Eric Wolfslagle. I'm with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. This is not an official U.S. Chamber of Commerce event. I don't know what pretenses you're here, but this is a fraudulent press activity and a stunt.
It has been a tough time for the chamber. The Obama administration is marginalizing the group because of its opposition not only to climate change legislation, but also health care reform and a proposed consumer financial protection agency. And big companies like Apple and the energy companies PG&E and Exelon have left the group, or as the CEO of a California consulting firm put it, the cool kids are leaving the room. So who is the Chamber of Commerce, and is it different from your local Chamber of Commerce? Michael Shear covers the White House for The Washington Post. Michael, start there. Who is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's pretty different than the local chambers in a lot of ways. The National Chamber is a group that represents about 300,000, you know, mostly big corporations, Toyota, Coca-Cola, Amazon, that kind of thing. And they're, you know, an established group of people here who have been lobbying Congress for decades. Local chambers, of course, are, you know, tend to represent the smaller businesses in your community, and they can vary. You know, a local chamber can be a pretty conservative group. It can be a more moderate or liberal group. I mean, it tends right. to still represent business interests, but it's a real different thing.
Right. Some local groups want to back more local businesses. Some want to bring in chains. But it is a local group as opposed to this nationwide lobbying group. They're not actually connected. And President Obama has been very pointed in his remarks to the national lobbying group.
Yeah. Take as an example an incident the other day when the National Chamber had run ads questioning the consumer protection efforts that the president is doing and saying that somehow the local butcher in a community was going to be affected. Of course, the president then called that totally false and said, as far as he knows, there's very few butchers that provide financial services, and also went after the chamber for having spent like $500 million on lobbying over the last decade.
Well, and is President Obama seeing an opening here? Because as we've said, the chambers seem to be losing support from not just this one company in California, but what others, including Republicans, are calling the cool kids. The cool companies seem to be leaving.
Well, I mean, I think you can't overstate it. I mean, there's been a handful of defections. The chamber still has a pretty powerful group. But I think what the administration is trying to do now that the chamber has opposed large swaths of his agenda, the health care bill, the financial re-regulation, the energy efforts, the president is trying to kind of marginalize that group and say, look, we don't need to use the chamber as the voice of business. We can draw on President Obama's appeal and invite CEOs, some of whom, many of whom are members of the chamber, but we can invite the CEOs directly to the White House and kind of go through them as opposed to going through the official chamber itself.
Well, in fact, we've talked to CEOs of businesses who have been to the White House, and they've been organized by groups like the U.S. Climate Action Partnership and the firm CERES, C-E-R-E-S, which has founded the pro-sustainability group Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy. Now, you say that the U.S. Chambers of Commerce is still pretty healthy, still has a lot of members. But do you see a time when the chamber might be replaced by one of these other groups?
Oh, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I mean, it's these kinds of established groups have an inertia, especially here in Washington, where, let's face it, the tides change and groups sort of ebb and then they come back again. You do think that an organization to survive is going to have to shift a little with it, and it will be interesting to see. So far, the chamber hasn't done that, but it'll be interesting to see whether they do.
Well, as we've been saying, some of the winds are coming from within, you know, so it's as businesses change, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the climate change thing is a really interesting example. You have a company like Apple. They're looked at as hip. And so when a company like that says, look, the chamber, we're just going to quit, that has a real loud echo to other businesses. And I'm sure has the folks inside the chamber thinking long and hard about what their next move is.
Michael Shear, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Michael, thanks so much.
Sure.
You know, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Just go to our website, hereandnow.org, and click on Contact Us to send an email. Or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hereandnow.org. Central America was a major front in a Cold War way back in the 1980s and 90s. Well, it may be again. The political stalemate in Honduras is being read as a proxy fight between the U.S. on one side and Cuba and Venezuela on the other. In Honduras, Roberto Micheletti assumed the presidency in June after a military-backed court ordered coup deposed the country's left-leaning and cowboy hat-wearing president, José Manuel Zelaya. The court claiming Zelaya tried to change the Constitution to hold on to power. But some observers say Zelaya's downfall has more to do with his support of the working man. He recently raised the minimum wage. Since the coup, the Obama administration has suspended foreign aid to Honduras in protest of Zelaya's ouster. But in a fascinating sidebar, veterans of the Cold War have hired Washington lobbyists for the new Honduran government, and Republican Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina defied the administration and made a trip to Honduras in support of the coup. He's also holding up Obama's nominations for top diplomatic posts in the region. Daniel Erickson is senior associate at the Inter-American Dialogue. He's also author of The Cuba Wars, Fidel Castro, the U.S. and the Next Revolution. He joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Dan, put all of this in perspective for us. How big a story is this?
Well, what's interesting is Honduras really is not a central issue in U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. However, in the last several months, you really have seen this emerge into a major clash, both between Republicans and Democrats in Washington, as well as having other actors in the region, such as Brazil, Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, and others, jump into the game, all trying to shape perceptions of the outcome.
We read in one report that when one of these Cold War warriors, a policymaker from the 80s, in support of the overthrow of Zelaya, organized a meeting for members of the Senate, there was a surprise turnout, one attendee saying, I've never seen so many senators in one room to talk about Latin America in my entire career. What is behind that?
I think what you have here is there's a major level of interest in Honduras because Mel Zelaya, who seemed to be a very close ally of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Therefore, when Zelaya was overthrown, there were many Republicans who disliked Hugo Chavez and therefore thought the overthrow of Zelaya was a good thing. And they were surprised and chagrined to see the Obama administration step forward and say, no, the removal of an elected president by the military is no longer acceptable, and calling for Zelaya's return as president of Honduras. And so that really precipitated a major cleavage between Republicans and Democrats in Washington in recent months that has had major repercussions in Honduras itself. whereby the government of Roberto Micheletti has found such steadfast support among some conservative leaders in the United States that he really doesn't see the need to make concessions.
In fact, we saw Jim DeMint defy John Kerry, who ordered him not to make a trip to visit the president that the U.S. is not backing, but he went anyway. Well, why is the Obama administration backing Zelaya outside of what you mentioned? Because didn't he, as accused by the country's Supreme Court, try to change the Constitution to stay in power?
It's clear that Zelaya does not have clean hands on this. He is someone who did indeed try to overrule the Supreme Court of his country in allowing for what has been described as a referendum, but was in fact a non-binding poll about whether Honduras should hold a constitutional assembly to draft a new constitution. And along the way, he made a lot of enemies. Mm-hmm. However, the fact is that he was woken up at 5 in the morning by the Honduran military, still in his pajamas, placed on a military plane, and forced out of the country. And I think that's really where the objection is, both on the part of the Obama administration and Latin America more broadly.
Well, meanwhile, Zelaya has since snuck back into the country. He's being kept in the Brazilian embassy since last month. We see pictures of him sleeping on a cot with his cowboy hat over his face. And the U.S., as we said, has held up any aid to Honduras. Now, what's that doing to the country? Because this is the poorest and one of the poorest in the world. How is this all impacting this country?
Honduras, like most of Central America, is going through one of the worst economic recessions in recent memory. And so clearly, this is very much pinching the government there. At the same time, Honduras has also had some of its trade relations with other Central American countries disrupted because many of its neighbors have condemned the coup. What you've seen is a classic case where political instability is really worsening the economic situation. And of course, that hurts the poor most.
Well, and what do you think is going to happen? Presidential elections are scheduled for the end of November. We understand that Micheletti is hoping to just hang on to the interim seat until then, and in the hopes that after the election, this will all blow over. What's your sense of what's going to happen?
Time is not on Zelaya's side. The fact is that you do have the elections coming up at the end of November. And at that point, if they are held, Micheletti's term will draw to an end, and it's going to be very hard to make the case for Zelaya to return to the presidency.
I just want to be clear. Constitutionally, he can't continue into the next term.
Yes, that's correct.
Right.
And so neither Micheletti nor Zelaya would be allowed to remain in the presidency past January when the new president is due to be inaugurated.
And does the U.S. just accept the results of the election and say, never mind about the stoppage of aid? I mean, where do you think this goes?
Right now, by declaring that the United States and other countries in the region will not recognize the Honduran elections, this has been used as a source of a leverage over Micheletti. However, once the elections have been held, it's not clear whether it's in the U.S. interest to continue punishing the successor government. You know, the elections offer, on the one hand, a potential solution to the Honduran crisis, but on the other hand, they could prolong it further.
Daniel Erickson, senior associate at the nonpartisan Inter-American Dialogue think tank in Washington, author of The Cuba Wars, Fidel Castro, the U.S. and the Next Revolution. Dan, given that, one quick question about Cuba. As we said, some see this debate over Honduras as sort of a proxy debate over Cuba and Venezuela. President Obama has eased restrictions on Cuban Americans traveling and sending money to Cuba, but he's also said that the trade embargo should stay in place until Cuba releases political prisoners and improves human rights. Is there anything that's happening in Honduras that's perhaps tied to changing some of those stands on Cuba?
U.S. policy towards Latin America remains very messy, and I think that while the engagement with Cuba is seen as a positive step by much of Latin America, at the same time, there's a real sense of unease about how the situation in Honduras has escalated. And I think what it's shown is it's very difficult, even today in 2009, for Republicans and Democrats in Washington to come together for a bipartisan defense of democracy in the hemisphere. The fact is the latent tensions of the Cold War are still with us and still dominate much of the political debate when it comes to Latin America.
Daniel Erickson, thanks so much.
Sure. It's great to be with you.
Okay, as we head into the break, here's a couple of stories in the pipeline at Here and Now. We're going to look at Amelia Earhart's legacy. She's now getting the Hollywood treatment. And we'll speak with animal psychologist Irene Pepperberg about her late friend Alex the Talking Parrot and her current research. That's ahead this week. Tomorrow, we'll look at the secret lives of classical composers from Franz Liszt who is a bit of a ladies' man, to Puccini, who stole his church's organ pipes and sold them for scrap. Bet you didn't know that. That's tomorrow. Back in a minute, here and now. Some news stories we're following for you. The Supreme Court today decided to hear the case of the Uyghurs, the group of Chinese Muslims, being held at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, even though the Pentagon no longer considers them a threat. The Obama administration had urged the court to stay out of the case, saying diplomatic efforts were underway to find a home for the Uyghurs, but now the court will hear their case early next year. And Dutch politician Geert Wilders, who has outraged Muslims by comparing the Koran to Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, will address Temple University students tonight, despite protests. Muslim students at Temple plan to protest the event, which was organized by a student group called Purpose. Question: what can a mother say to her young children when she knows she's about to die?
I'm sorry. I won't be around to help you and watch you grow up.
That's Frank Farrow, 25 years old now, reading a letter written to him and his three brothers by their mother, Gail Farrow, before she died of AIDS in 1989.
You boys make me proud. You are handsome, smart, and already care about each other. When things are happy, think of me smiling at you.
But somehow Gail's words were lost in the painful years after her death, until the boy's father, Ronald, dug them out of storage just recently. Theirs is a story about a family that might have been, except for AIDS. Photojournalist David Binder tells it in his new documentary, Calling My Children. David spent nearly every day of 2 years with Gail and Ronald and the boys, documenting their lives in the Boston neighborhood of Mission Hill until her death. He returned to update their story. The result is the new documentary, and David joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
You know, we see in the film pictures that you took back then in the late 80s, these beautiful boys, you know, a family that had some struggles, but it still seemed like such a family. What did you find, you know, almost two decades later?
The family in Gail's death had disintegrated. A couple years passed as Ronald, the father, tried his best to maintain as an immediate single father of four children. And through that process, the kids, 20 years plus, are now all young adults with this common tragedy in their lives.
Yeah. Where is the family now? We understand that Ronald, the dad, is an assistant teacher in the area. The oldest son, Ronald Jr., was recently released from prison. He was held there awaiting arraignment on arms possession charges, but those charges have since been dropped. What about the other sons?
Frank, who's the second oldest, is going to return to college down south after a year or so at Boston College. And the twins, Kenny and Benny, are in Boston. Kenny is married, and Benny is engaged, and they are expecting their first child.
And at least one of them, I think it was Kenny, is angry about this, angry still.
He's a little tough guy. You know, and he might put on a little more than he is.
Frank, on the other hand, the second oldest son?
That's right.
Not tough at all. In fact, a staggering moment in the film really has little sound. It's all picture. And he is sobbing, the tears just falling off his face as he reads the letter that we just heard, those sentences that we just heard. And he looked up at you and he said, I didn't know this.
Mm.
But he did know it at some point. He had heard that letter at some point.
Mm. His father was surprised to hear that Frank believes he never saw that letter until that moment. His father remembers that he showed Frank the letter, but unfortunately, Frank was too young to remember it. And his father didn't have a good realization that perhaps his son was too young, and Ronald didn't revisit that with Frank.
Right, because Ronald, the father, began to succumb to drug and alcohol problems. Mm. The kids went to live with Gail's mom. Tell us a little more about her. As we said, you spent this time with her. She probably contracted AIDS through a blood transfusion for cervical cancer in 83. What was she like when you met her in the late 80s?
She was a devoted mother, doting on her children, and the heightened awareness that she had increasingly little time to spend with them was all that she was focused on.
You say that she didn't go to the hospital as much as doctors wanted her to because she wanted to spend time with the kids.
Yeah, she and her doctor became very close, and he stopped trying after a while to encourage her to stay in the hospital because he knew he would lose that conversation. And she came home as much as possible, despite pain and even attentive care, to be with her kids.
Getting ready for birthday parties while, what, cleaning out catheters?
Yeah, whatever it took.
At a time when, we should say, the stigma around AIDS was enormous. This was before Magic Johnson, which is a marker. Did she tell you that she was concerned about the family staying together?
She did, and in the letter that she left for her husband, she tells him that she knows that she can count on him to keep the family together and to maintain the dreams and the hopes that they had together for their kids.
But he was furious at the hospital that gave her the blood transfusion, at God for allowing her to get sick. Let's listen to a little of him describing now how he felt then.
I remember thinking of how I could go down and blow up City Hospital, or how I wanted to find out who gave her that blood and what I would do to them. But how do I know that the person that gave her the blood really was out there using drugs? How do I know that that person that gave her the blood didn't get it the same way she got it?
And this anger didn't help when he took up drugs, alcohol. He said he didn't do it while you were with the family.
That's right.
When you were photographing them. But after she died, he went deep into alcohol and drugs and even left his kids home to go out and sell drugs.
I got high trying to die like she did. I wanted to get the same pain as she got because I should have had it, not her.
So, David Binder, that can't have been good for the boys.
You know, he became an instant single father of four little boys, and he did the best he could for whatever it was, a year or two after he lost the love of his life, and then he lost it. He just couldn't do it anymore. He had no personal time to grieve, and he felt as though he deserved all of the pain that Gail went through.
Well, and he didn't do what Gail instructed him to do until it might be too late. She told him, you're a strong man, get help if you need help. He didn't. And now, though, it seems as if he is responding to those words of almost two decades ago. Did it seem to you that when you went back this time that that was his intent, to try to bring his boys back together, to try to help them understand what happened to their family?
Yeah, sure. It's a long process of him coming to terms with all of that, as it's a long process for the kids to come to terms with the loss of their mother.
What's your sense of what this moment's going to do for them?
That's the question. We don't know, do we? Frank's an amazing guy. Frank, at 5 years old, is the man who took care of his mother every day. His father was at work. His older brother was in school. And his younger brothers were 2.5 years old. And Frank grew in to be the caretaker of the entire family. And he's going to get back to college. His girlfriend just graduated from Boston University School of Public Health with her master's. And I guess I expect great things from him.
And even though this horrible pain we see him in, as if he sounds as if he didn't know that his mother loved him this much. He didn't know these words, even though he might have heard them when he was a little kid.
Or he actually has always known, and he has been the most connected to his mother because of that time they spent together when he was 5 years old. And it's all validation to him, reading that letter and hearing his mother talk to him like that. He's gotten that confirmation of everything that he's felt in connection to his mother.
It's David Binder. His new documentary film is Calling My Children. It tells of a father and four boys who lost the mother in the family to AIDS in the 1980s. The film recently won first prize for Best Documentary Short at both the Athens International Film and Video Festival and the Roxbury Film Festival here in Massachusetts. David, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Robin, really, thanks for your interest.